I think the body of literature coming out of the migration field has more or less concluded that relatively few people move solely because of environmental change. But that a lot of people are exposed to a combination of factors that include economic problems, political instability, social breakdowns in social order, or conversely, social opportunities and networks, demographic pressures, and environmental factors that lead people to move. But there's also a sense that climate change may well exacerbate the environmental aspects of that equation. Again, not necessarily as the sole or maybe even the primary reason people are moving, but because those other factors are exacerbated as a result of climate change. And we're thinking often in terms of four different scenarios that may affect human mobility. First is intensified drought and desertification, and that's largely because that can have very deep adverse effects on livelihoods, on the ability of people to support themselves, not particularly for those who are involved in subsistence agriculture, but for others as well. Second scenario is rising sea levels that inundate coastal areas, deltas, and that may be particularly harmful to small island states where there may not be a choice. I've been in meetings with government officials from some of the island states in the Pacific who, when told, well, many people, as I'll get to, move internally, they say there won't be an internal for us to move to, and therefore this will be a larger issue than just people relocating a few miles from home. But there are also areas with deltas, Bangladesh comes to mind, where there are also very large populations, unlike the small island states, where people may have very little choice other than to move because their property is now salinated or even more underwater. Third scenario is the intensification of acute natural hazards, hurricanes, cyclones, typhoons. That can lead to people having to being uprooted because of the natural hazard, which often can lead into a natural disaster if it's of a certain scale or there's a lack of governance to respond adequately to the natural hazard. And finally, an area which is definitely of interest for today's discussions is the potential for competition over natural resources that become more scarce as a result of the previous impacts and could result in intensified conflict, which could turn to mass movements of people. So those are some of the dynamics that we think are happening as a result of climate change. But again, people don't move just because of the environmental factor, usually, exceptions, as I've noted, but because they worsen other aspects of life, particularly livelihoods, and particularly related to poor governance. But the mobility patterns will differ very much depending on which of these scenarios we're talking about. So drought and rising sea levels are likely to lead to gradual movements of people, a lot of anticipatory migration that occurs as people try to manage the risk of the worsening conditions that they're facing. And households decide that some part of the household will stay and try to keep farming despite the drought or salinization, but others will move to cities or move to other countries in order to be able to diversify the sources of livelihoods and sources of support for the family. I'll come back to this, but this can be very positive adaptation strategy, but it can also pose some risks to some people. The third and fourth scenarios that I mentioned, the acute natural disasters and conflict, will more likely lead to emergency displacement. And that those are the scenarios of mass movements of people as a result of the very acute events as compared to the more slow onset processes of the first group of impacts. We think that most of the mobility will be internal, vast majority of it. For example, rural to urban movements within a single country. There are posits, though, of urban to rural migration, particularly when it's coastal cities that are at the highest risk. And there may not be other cities for them to move to. So we could see some reversal of the urbanization processes that have been the dominant form of movement internally, and then also rural to rural movements in this context. Although these will be, we think, much more prevalent, there will be a certain amount of cross-border movement as well. Some cases, there, as I said, there is no internal option, and international movements are very much expected in those situations. But in other cases, the closest place that you can get to that's safe may be cross a border rather than internal. Or there may be pre-existing labor migration patterns of movement that make it actually easier for people to go some distance to escape whatever it is that they is already happening or that they think will happen in the future. But it's likely that those will be much smaller in volume than the movements that will tend to be either internal or immediate cross-border. The problem, of course, with the immediate cross-border is that a lot of those situations will be people going from the frying pan into the fire, so to speak, Bangladeshis crossing the border into India. And the parts of India which are experiencing very much the same environmental impacts that Bangladesh itself is experiencing. And places that may not have the governance, the infrastructure, the employment, or other things to be able to absorb the people as they're coming. But the group that a lot of attention is being placed on right now, but I think not sufficient, but it's a reflection of what Beth was talking about with planned relocation, are the people who can't move. That in many cases, these are going to be the most at-risk population. Migration is very, very expensive. Having the financial resources, the social networks, the access to transportation, all of the things that you need in order to move short and long distances costs a lot. And the real fear is that we're going to end up with large numbers of trapped people who can't get out of harm's way. This is the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. If you think about where the high death rates were, they were in places where people were trapped, whether it's a nursing home or Ward 8. You have places where people, either because of poverty or infirmity or others, were just unable to get out of the way and couldn't evacuate in time and experienced the largest risks. Now, the coping capacity that people will have to allow them to remain in situ or to benefit from migration will depend on their own levels of vulnerability and resilience, as well as the vulnerability and resilience of the environments and the institutions surrounding them. I won't go through all of these in detail, but they're, you know, do they have sustainable livelihoods already? Do they have, how poor is the household? Are there people within the household who have a greater possibility? It's not unusual in refugee situations to find that young men in particular are able to get further afield. They can do the dangers of the trip across the Mediterranean or across land borders, get to wealthier countries. Whereas the poorer populations, the older, the young children, women with that type of childbearing responsibilities may not be able to get as far. Just because of the levels of vulnerability that they may have apart from being affected by the environmental factors. But there are also some positive things that if you have assets, you're more likely to be able to move and move farther distances. And extremely importantly, if you have social networks somewhere else, you're much more likely to be able to move. We did a sort of quick and dirty study that was looking at Senegal, Bangladesh, and Mexico in areas that are likely to be heavily affected already are. And one of the conclusions was though Mexico is much lower down the list of countries that are going to be affected by climate change, the potential for movement is much higher because the social networks exist already that allow people to move to elsewhere. So they have greater resilience because of their existing networks. This is what Beth already mentioned, so I won't get into detail, but the Cancun Adaptation Framework has already recognized this variation in forms of movement. But then where do we stand in terms of adaptation and then how that may relate to conflict? There are flip sides of adaptation and migration. A lot of the attention so far is on how to reduce emigration pressures, how to help people stay in situ rather than have to move, whether it's modifying agricultural and fishing practices, drought-resistant seeds, ways of turning saline water into drinkable, potable water, management of pastoral lands, which I assume we'll hear more about next presentation, dikes, et cetera. All of these are things which governments are thinking about. They show up in the national adaptation plans. Relatively little thinking yet, though, about the extent to which they're realistic options for reducing the immigration pressures and whether they're actually getting at what it is, how the environmental factors intersect with the other economic, political, et cetera, factors, and the vulnerabilities and resilience to determine whether people can move. And so a lot more needs to be done in just assessing the likelihood that these adaptation plans, if they're being sold to reduce emigration pressures, will actually have that result. I think it's actually I'm quite skeptical in many of the cases. But the other side is migration as adaptation. Migration is a risk of strategy, management strategy. It's a way people have coped for millennia when the environment changes. So why would we think that people won't cope in exactly the same way today and moving forward? Need for the relocation of at-risk populations, as Beth talked about. Efforts to provide alternatives to displacement. Though migration can be a very positive thing for people, displacement may be positive in being life-saving, but not necessarily positive in terms of people's future well-being. And certainly if that displacement becomes protracted, as we have seen becoming the norm with refugees and increasingly, unfortunately, becoming more common with natural disasters. Again, thinking about Katrina, some of those who were evacuated never were able to come back home. Fortunately, many of them were able to integrate into new communities, but the period of time that they were living in temporary shelters was actually quite long relative to what one would want to see happen in these situations. So trying to reduce displacement as a factor. And then tapping migrants and diasporas as a resource to support adaptation and mitigation strategies. In Mexico, I visited a village that has a lot of labor migration. Most of the migrants are in Los Angeles. And they were actually sending money back to the village to plant trees in an area where there were recurrent mudslides whenever there was a flash flood. And so also the university in that area in Jalisco had an arrangement through some migrants who had gotten to the U.S., grew up there, got their PhDs in agricultural sciences, and made an arrangement with the University of Wisconsin to provide technical assistance to the farmers in that area. So the diaspora can play a very positive role. There are very potential positive impacts for benefits, certainly for those who migrate, although not everyone reaps those benefits. Research is showing that only those with existing resilience possibilities and lesser levels of vulnerability are likely to benefit from even anticipatory migration. Others may survive, but still others do worse economically because they don't have the coping capabilities. But migration can also have these benefits for those left behind, as in my case in Mexico. But there are potential negative impacts. As I said, people who move aren't necessarily better off. And not only is it their own levels of resilience and vulnerability, but it's also government policies. If there are no legal ways you can move where you need to go, whether it's internal or international, the chances are people are going to be at significantly higher risk. And then displacement becomes the norm rather than safe and orderly migration. The dependence on migration can also undermine other adaptation strategies. The same village, the business people that we interviewed said that they have jobs that they cannot fill because the default is to move to Los Angeles. And the possibility for building up the corporate world there is much more restricted than it would be with more people feeling that they could stay home and have an economic future there. And then the big issue that's, again, related to the topic of this meeting is that there can be very, very significant tensions between migrants displaced and relocated and the destination communities into which they move, particularly when those destinations have not been well prepared and have had no sense of say over these new arrivals. And where government institutions are very weak and not enough assistance is provided to the newcomers as well as to the existing communities. We see this a lot in refugee contexts, where money goes to one place or another, but not in an integrated way, and where the government silos that lead to that form of financing is really leading to the potential for much greater conflict than might be the case if there could be ways of addressing those. And so the policy challenges and where we kind of need to go is that there are a lack of clear standards. Beth referred to those, and I won't go into detail. Gaps in international law and national laws. I tend to agree with Beth that the guiding principle concept is probably going to go further than any possibility of having a new convention. But at the national level, most countries are not really thinking about what type of legal frameworks they need in order to be able to address these issues, either through internal or international movement. We have temporary protection mechanisms that sometimes work, but I'll give you an example of one of the problems with ours. The US, we have a temporary protected status. We've issued it in a number of different contexts that are very similar with natural disasters. environmental problems. But in one respect, they're not working because there's no end state. Those who were in the United States at the time of Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Mitch in Central America, or the earthquakes in El Salvador, 1998-2000, still have temporary protection because there's no way of adjusting them to permanent status, and there's no assistance for return. And their remittances are still very important. Another case, though, is Montserrat, where temporary protection was renewed about 5 or 6 times, and then the definitive study came out that people could not, in the foreseeable or probably ever, return to Montserrat safely. And it was no longer temporary, so the status was lifted. And fortunately, there were relatively few people. They could be accommodated. But if we had a larger population, just when they needed the solution, it wasn't forthcoming. So what can we do? We can foster positive adaptation alternatives, ones that help people remain in place, but also help them move in safety and dignity and help the communities into which they're moving. And when these are done voluntarily and with appropriate planning and resources, they can help mitigate the potential for conflict amongst the movers and the existing population. We can involve the diaspora even more. USAID has programs for the diaspora, but not linking those programs into environmental change or conflict mitigation as an issue. This would be a very fruitful area for some movement. Certainly in this context, supporting disaster risk reduction, conflict mediation, and improvements in humanitarian response would help the people who are affected, but also would help to avert future conflict. And then, and ending pretty much where Beth did, identify the guiding principles and effective practices where we can try to mitigate some of the potential harms to come. Thank you.